I'm Julie Kraftchick.
And I'm Yue Xu. This is The Psychology of Relationships. Let's talk about sex, and not just the surface level stuff, because our sexual experiences, frustrations, and desires are deeply shaped by the psychology of how we think, feel, attach, and relate, not just to our partners, but to ourselves. In this episode, we're joined by Emily Nagoski, PhD, health educator, researcher, and author of the New York Times bestselling book, Come As You Are. Emily's one of the most influential voices in sexual well-being today. Her work blends neuroscience, clinical psychology, emotion regulation, and stress research to help us understand our sexual selves with more clarity, compassion, and confidence. She's also the co-author of Burnout and author of Come Together, expanding her work into relational intimacy and the psychology of resilience. We dig into why sexual desire isn't one size fits all, and why that's not a flaw, but part of our psychological wiring. Emily breaks down the dual control model, explaining what makes us hit the gas or slam on the brakes when it comes to arousal. We also explore how stress, body image, attachment patterns, trauma history, and relational dynamics shape our sexual experiences far more than people realize. And we discuss the natural ebbs and flows of desire across different life stages, from high stress periods to major transitions. Because sexual satisfaction isn't about performance, frequency, or comparison, it's about safety, connection, self-awareness, and being understood. And the more we understand the psychology behind sex, the more empowered we become to show up for ourselves and each other with honesty and ease. Remember to go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen and leave us a rating and review, especially with a comment about what you learned from this episode. This is The Psychology of Relationships, and you're listening to an episode that just might change the way you show up for love. Enjoy. Emily Nagoski, you've heard her name over and over again. I've had so many friends recommend your book to me, Come As You Are. And we are so incredibly honored to have you with us today. Hi, Emily.
Hello.
And there she is.
We're so excited to have you, Emily. I feel like your book is just kind of like a rite of passage. Like, and you said the first version was released in 2015. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah.
And then you updated again for 2021. What were some of the changes in the 2021 version?
Some of it is detailed stuff, making sure the science was still as up to date as it could possibly be. The science matters a lot to me, having it be as evidence-based as possible. But some of it was pretty large-scale shift. So maybe the largest change was to the desire chapter, chapter 7. So the core idea in that chapter is that most of us, by the time we get to adulthood, we have this story in our head of how sexual desire is supposed to work. And that narrative is something like spontaneous desire, where you're just like walking down the street and you suddenly, out of the blue, all of a sudden are just like, "Ooh, I would like to have some sex. How about?" And you go to your partner like, "I would like to have the sex. How about that?" And that's spontaneous desire. It appears in anticipation of pleasure, essentially. Yes, that is a normal, healthy way to experience sexual desire. Absolutely. Nothing wrong with that. And there's also another normal, healthy way to experience desire, which is responsive desire, where instead of it just like trucking down the street and you like it suddenly just occurs to you, "Oh, sex is a good idea." You might be like just like sitting on the couch, flipping through Netflix, you haven't chosen something to watch, and your certain special someone is sitting next to you and starts just like touching you in a really lovely way. And that sensation goes up to your brain and is like, "So this is happening." And your brain's like, "That's really nice." And then like a little bit more keeps happening, and that sensation goes up to your brain, and the sensation's like, so this is happening. What do you think?" And your brain's like, yeah, that's really nice. And maybe you turn toward your partner and you start like doing some kissing on them. And then your brain says, "So this sensation is happening. What do you think?" And your whole self is like, "You know what? How about this sexy time? How about we get some sex? How about that?" It emerges.
How about we do it? Let's do the dirty.
It's called responsive desire because it emerges in response to pleasure, where spontaneous desire emerges in anticipation of pleasure. And it's news to a lot of people that responsive desire is 100% normal, natural, healthy. In fact, the couples who sustain strong connections over the long term, regardless of their relationship structure, whether they're like monogamous married or poly married or open relationship, this is their only like long-term sexual relationship. They come and go in this relationship. If you want to sustain a strong sexual connection with another person over the long term, it is not going to be a relationship characterized primarily by spontaneous desire. That is not what the research shows. The research is unambiguous that couples who sustain a long-term sexual connection with each other, primarily that relationship is characterized by responsive desire. In the first version of Come As You Are, I said, so that responsive desire is normal too. But I know everybody hears that and is like, well, it's all well and good that it's normal, but let's face it, spontaneous desire is better. So the first version of Come As You Are is, here's some strategies to get to spontaneous desire if that really matters for you. And the more research accumulated over the following years, the more I was like, no, people need to let go of spontaneous desire because it truly, deeply does not matter. And their pursuit of spontaneous desire is actually interfering with their ability to have very pleasurable sex. Pleasure is the central defining characteristic of great sexual connections. It is not how much you can't wait to put your tongue in the other person's mouth. It is how much you enjoy it when you do put your tongue in the other person's mouth. So I switched the entire function of that chapter to being like, not only is responsive desire normal, it is the thing that you should be focusing on.
This is so fast. I'm so glad we're starting here because I think it's important to define what these two desires mean. Because in my head, when I read this chapter, I kept thinking, you know, one of the complaints that my partner has is that I don't initiate. I respond. And I love being like, you talk about contextual, when all my ducks in a row, I feel good and he initiates, that's when I get really turned on. So for someone who, you know, I very much focus on the responsive desire, but someone still has to initiate that chain of events, right? And wouldn't that be part of the spontaneous desire?
Maybe. Or, so the complicating factor in the picture that I have seen you painting here is that feeling wanted is a big part of what puts you in a desirous state of mind. It's part of what arouses you. You're like, everything's going great, the context is positive, and then your partner approaches you in a way that feels really good. And like, that's the thing that kicks you over to the edge until like, oh, right, yeah, this person wants me. Yeah, all right. And probably your partner would really like it if you initiated because they also like to feel wanted.
For sure.
And initiation often makes it feel like this person wants me. And like, you do want your partner, right? Like, you enjoy the sex that you have together.
Absolutely.
So you don't have to have a spontaneous kind of like horny bones feeling in order to initiate sex.
So let's go into that a little more. I want to talk about what dictates our sexual response, because you have a lot of interesting research about just like,
how long do we have?
All day.
what makes us want to like pump the brakes versus like put the gas pedal on? Can you kind of go into that a little more?
So what you're talking about there is the good old dual control model, which is the mechanism in your brain that controls sexual response. And as you can tell by the name, the dual control model, it's got two primary parts. It has a sexual accelerator or gas pedal, which notices all the sex-related stimulation in the environment. So that's everything you see, hear, smell, touch, think, believe, or imagine that your brain codes as sex-related. And it sends the turn-on signal that many of us are familiar with. And it's functioning all the time at a level below consciousness. Here we are talking about sex, thinking about the idea of sex, like what would count as like a sound that's sex related to me? What would count as a smell that's sex related to me? Just that little bit is enough to be like, well, there's some sex related thinking, and so I'm going to send a turn on signal. Fortunately, at the same time, in parallel, your brakes, the other part of it, are noticing all the good reasons not to be turned on right now. Everything that you see, hear, smell, touch, taste, think, believe, or imagine that your brain codes as a potential threat. And this is the big one. This is the normalizing, oh, look, it's totally normal and healthy and good for there to be things hitting my brake. And the process of arousal is a dual process of turning on the ons, yes, but also turning off the offs. And it turns out when people are struggling with any aspect of their sexual functioning, arousal, pleasure, desire, orgasm, sometimes it's because there's not enough stimulation to the accelerator, but much more often it's because there's too much stimulation to the brake, because stress hits the brake, body image stuff hits the brake, trauma history hits the brake, relationship trouble hits the brakes, your kids hit the brake.
You think? So is this one and the same of your sex drive, or do you describe it differently? You hear people always be like, yeah, my sex drive. Yeah.
The technical language would say that sex is not a drive, because a drive is a biological mechanism in an organism's body that is like an alarm, like a flashing red light and a wooga klaxon sound that there's some problem that needs to get solved. And there's an uncomfortable internal experience that pushes the animal out into the world to go solve that problem. Hunger is a drive. Thirst is a drive. Sleep is a drive. Thermoregulation. If you do not meet these needs, awooga, awooga, there's a problem. Fix it. If you don't meet these needs, what happens? Eventually, you will literally die. You can literally die of sleep deprivation. You can literally die of loneliness, right? Love, connection is a biological drive. Sex is not one of those. Nobody has ever died because they couldn't get laid.
They may think they might.
They may feel uncomfortable. Feeling uncomfortable or frustrated is not the same as suffering tissue damage. And the fact that you have been told this before, the fact that you say jokingly people feel like they might, is actually super important.
So if sex is not a drive, what is it then? How do we categorize it?
Let me, I'm realistic. I know we're not going to live in a world where we all say that sex is an incentive motivation system. Sex drive is so much easier to say. Everybody, but if we can understand that we're using it in a sort of like layperson term, a casual, not literal kind of way, if we can recognize that we're using the term sex drive, what we actually mean is a sexual incentive motivation system that is not analogous to hunger, but rather to curiosity, exploration, play. All of these things are equally innate to us. The difference is just that we don't die if we don't get it. And our desire to explore, to read new books, to play new games, to watch new movies is, it comes and goes, right? There are some times when you just want to like watch the same movie you've watched 1,000 times, read the same book you've read 1,000 times. There are times when all you want to do is like curl up in bed in silence. Those are times when you are feeling stressed, overwhelmed, exhausted, anxious, depressed. Those are the times when you're not interested in sex too, probably. Well, 80 to 90% of people, those are times when your interest in sex is like, no, thanks.
I want to break down the dual control model a little more. And I think the overarching theme I got from your book is that everything is normal. There's nothing that isn't. And I think that's really important, especially with sex, that can be such a sensitive topic.
People will want to argue with that. So let me make sure, because people find it very difficult to be like, okay, what do you mean everything is normal? Do you mean everything is normal? And here are two things that do not count as normal from my point of view. One, unwanted pain. It's not supposed to hurt unless you choose for it to hurt. If you enjoy pain with your sexual experience, great, go for it. And the reason that happens is explained in chapter 3. So you go. But unwanted pain is not normal. Talk to a medical provider. And I don't say that glibly, because a lot of people, when they're experiencing pain with sex, get dismissed by medical providers who don't know better. So you are going to have to put legwork into finding a provider who will take you seriously and refer you to, for example, a physical therapist, which is like the most promising intervention for most experiences of sexual pain. So that's one thing that's not normal. If you're experiencing, and I have had this conversation where people are like, and it hurt, but like that was just, you know, and I was like, no, that is a thing that not to accept. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to, go ahead, but no. And then the second thing that's not normal, obviously, is lack of consent.
Yeah.
Everybody involved should be glad to be there and free to leave whenever they choose without any consequences.
Right. I'm glad that you specified that. I think what I thought was good about the normal comment was more of different desires mm-hmm. and different, you know, like the sexual breaks.
Everything
and
else
gas
is
pedal.
Normal. Your breaks are normal. Responsive desire is normal. Arousal non-concordance, where there's a mismatch between your genitals and how you feel emotionally. That's normal. If you want to fuck your partner's armpit, that is normal. There's a word for it. It's called axillary intercourse. Do you? As long as everybody involved is glad to be there and free to leave without consequence, go for it. You can do anything you want. All normal.
Love it. I think what was really fun, though, in your book is there was a quiz about the sexual excitation system, the SE, and the sexual inhibition system, SI. And you were saying the most common was to kind of be in the middle for both.
Yep.
You and I took the quiz, which was super fun. I actually scored super high in the sexual excitation and low in the sexual inhibition.
Okay.
Julie's like turned on right now.
There's nothing, apparently, but you were more in the middle.
I was definitely in the middle. Both. And I think what was so groundbreaking for me in this chapter, Emily, and I'm so grateful for you for telling us this, is a lot of times we focus on the SE and not so much the SI, and they are separate things. So when we don't have sex for a while with our partner, we think we're missing the stimulation, mm-hmm. we're missing the excitation. So we focus so much of our time on buying lingerie and going out in public and trying to have sex in public. When the SI, I'm actually more sensitive in that area. I have more breaks than I do excitation. Mm. So I have to work on eliminating more of the breaks for me to really get aroused.
Interesting. And then I wanted to ask you, Emily, how do you think it differs for men and women?
When you look at the research, it does, like, if you had to guess which group, men or women, had overall more sensitive accelerators?
Probably men. Yep.
Yeah. And who has the more sensitive breaks? As a population, if you average together the break sensitivity of 100 women and the break sensitivity of 100 men, the average score of the women is going to be higher. There is an enormous range of variability, as just the two of you represent. People vary tremendously, and all of that variation is normal. There's nothing dysfunctional about any of it. It does mean that there's different prognoses, but why do men score higher on average on exciters and lower on inhibitors? Is it innate? The only way we would know if it was like biologically innate as if we tested it in like 1 hour old infant humans. And I don't see anyone getting like human IRB approval for like
not yet
studying that.
Right. This research.
Like, what's the ethical? Yeah. That's so I guess it could be innate, but it is probably because of the cultural messages with which a human being is raised from the moment mm-hmm. of their birth mm-hmm. based on like the shape of the genitals between their legs that makes the adults around them go, it's a boy or it's a girl. You get totally different messages. Actually was told the story of a woman who read Come As You Are and then watched her adult grown-up brother changing his baby daughter's diaper. And when she was all clean and ready to go, he reaches to get the diaper. And when he turns back, little baby daughter is touching her own genitals. Mm. And dad goes, don't touch that. And like, you have to wonder, how would he have responded if his baby had had a penis instead?
Oh yeah. Be like, mm-hmm. go for it. Keep going.
Yeah. Like, ha ha. Or if she had been touching any other body part, like, don't we love it when babies mm-hmm. touch, like, find their feet? Did you find your feet? Oh, you got the cutest little feet. So she's not going to remember, this baby's not going to remember that moment of her dad scolding her for touching her own body, but it will accumulate with countless other moments that she also will not remember. Right. So that by the time she gets to adolescence and adulthood, there's going to be this dark place in her brain where her genitals should be, because she's been taught over years of virtually silent messages that that part of her body does not belong to her, and it's a source of shame and disgust. Mm.
So would you say then still that the majority of people, like from your research, fall in the middle of both? Or
yeah.
Okay, so that's still like regardless of your sexual preference, regardless of your gender, sex, like all of that, it's kind of even distribution on the bell curve.
Yeah, there have been multiple studies with many, many different populations. conversations. And it just over and over again, it turns out it has the same sort of distribution as any personality trait where like most people are heaped up in the middle and then there's a few people out right. on the edges. But the people who are out on the edges are not abnormal. They're just right. atypical. And it does result in different pronuses. So if you have a particular, like for example, if you have a really sensitive accelerator, especially if it's in combination with a not particularly sensitive brake, that sounds like it can be really fun. And in the right context, it absolutely can be. But these are also the folks who might be most at risk for using sex as a strategy to manage stress, depression, anxiety, loneliness, repressed rage. We've all got it. Or engage in compulsive sexual behavior or sexual risk taking. In the wrong context, it can actually increase risk.
Yeah. I wonder though, because I scored high and low, but it's some of its context because I'm with someone.
All of it is context.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, I don't know if I would have if I wasn't with the current partner I'm with right this
yes.
minute.
Yes. Yeah.
I was going to ask, how often does that change?
It's like introversion, extroversion. Like you have a personality, a proneness, a temperament. So I'm like a real strong introvert. But even I phase into times of like wanting to spend more time with people and feeling more energized and less drained by time with people, depending on the context and the situation. It's going to vary the way you'll respond to those questions. There'll be a sort of like a proneness that you'll notice that you tend to have a more or less sensitive gas pedal compared to your partner or other people. But where it falls precisely is going to vary depending on the context. Yeah.
And so should we take the quiz at different points in our life, depending on context?
Don't stress. What will it do for you to have a different score on a little Cosmo quiz? Like I used items from the actual science, but like that is not a scientific quiz. It's very much like a Cosmo quiz just to give you a place to start in thinking about the sensitivity of your accelerator and brake. And for most people, because most people are in the middle, it's much less about how sensitive are my brakes and accelerator and much more about like there's a break.
Right.
So let's talk about those breaks in context a little more because I think context is key as we keep playing
Heck
into.
Yes.
So
yes.
I feel like in movies you see it's just like let's put some candles and roses and then we're going to immediately have sex. Like which right. cues do you think matter more than others and which ones don't?
Which cues matter more? Okay, so when you look at the research, it's really so rarely about what I actually think. Sometimes it's about what I think, but mostly it's what does the research tells us. And the research tells us that personal well-being really matters, mental and physical health. Obviously, if you currently have the flu, that's not going to facilitate really flexible and responsive turning off the brakes. Like you're just going to be like, no. Partner characteristics. And we can think flexibly about what counts as a partner characteristic because it varies from person to person. For me, it's sense of humor. Like when my partner is funny, that's like a big deal for me. My sister is a musician, married to a musician. So for her, sitting in the living room when he's in the piano room practicing, she's just sitting there like,
turned on.
I married the right man. Right. And that's like, that's not a thing for me, but it is a thing for her. So partner characteristics writ large. Sometimes it might be, even though, you know, parenting is not a sexy behavior. If you have kids and you're watching your co-parent with your kids, you can just be like, damn, I'm with the right person. I made a good choice here. Or like doing whatever their job is and they're really good at it and you just love seeing them be extraordinary at whatever their thing is. So partner characteristics is the second thing. The third thing is relationship characteristics. Most important among the relationship characteristics is trust. So there's a relationship researcher and therapist named Sue Johnson who developed emotionally focused therapy, EFT.
Yeah.
And she defines trust as basically the answer to the question, are you there for me? R meaning, so R stands for emotionally accessible, emotionally responsive, and emotionally engaged. When I show up with a feeling, you are emotionally present and with me, responsive and engaged. And it's extremely important with sex because there's a lot of vulnerability involved in sex. You might be taking off some clothes and letting somebody see parts of your body almost no one else will see. Or touching parts of your body almost no one else will touch. You might be putting a part of your body inside a part of someone else's body or letting them put a part of their body right. in inside your body. Like, it takes so much trust. And if you take off your clothes and your partner is like, wow, yay, and thank you, then they are really there for you.
Yeah.
Whereas if you show up and take off your clothes and your partner's like, you know, okay.
Right. I mean, right? I could see that having a huge impact on your, that I would probably score totally different if I took that quiz with that.
Yeah, that's, you know? That's a partner who's not there for you. And that's like a key relationship factor.
I love the example you gave in your book with someone when they asked her partner, why do you want to have sex? Why do you like having sex with me? And her partner answered, because you're beautiful. And I really love this example because it wasn't about treating her like a piece of meat because you're hot or I like your body. He's just saying baseline, you're beautiful. I'm just so attracted to you. And to me, that's also something that is an SE for me to hear, you know, something, these words of affirmation.
Yeah. So in that real story, it's grounded in like a true story. And it was specifically about someone who was feeling very self-conscious about the changes that had happened to her body after having a child. Like, so much happens to your body. And it's not just that there are like visible physical changes. It's that like the way your body experiences sensations changes. The meaning of your various body parts changes. And she was really struggling with learning how to love this body.
Mm-hmm.
And she had absorbed, as we all have, a lot of like cultural messages about like getting your pre-baby body back and blah, blah, blah. It's all bullshit and noise.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that later if you want to. But what he said when she was like, why would you even want to have sex with this is actually what she said. Why would you want to have sex with this? And he's like, because you're beautiful. And I've heard the story over and over, actually, especially after the book came out. Men kept telling me about how gorgeous they found their partners after they had a child.
Mm.
That like they like either like were in no way bothered by the changes or actively loved the changes to their partner's body after a child came along. And yeah, I have also heard stories about men who were like, well, I don't know, she doesn't look the way she used to. But many more stories of men being like, she gets hotter every day.
Well, if you want to have sex, that's what you should be saying, because the other is going to turn it off.
And not just what you say, but what you actually feel, because like, let's face it, like when you are in a long-term relationship, especially if you like get married and do the whole like till death do us part thing, I don't know about you, but like I intend not to die while still having the body I currently have. I got decades ahead of me, I hope. If I'm lucky enough to grow old and my partner is lucky enough to grow old, then both of us are going to be old, baggy, wrinkled, bald, gray-haired, scars from surgery, metal hips. Like, our bodies are going to be really different by the time death does us part. That's the deal. Like, when you get married because your partner looks the way they do, you're not marrying that body. You're marrying the whole future of that body. That's love.
I want to dive into this even more, but before we do, let's take a quick break to hear from our partners.
Staying present in a relationship might be really difficult sometimes because it's not just one date. It's every night on the couch, every meal, every, wait, what did you just say? Moment. That's where Brick comes in. Brick is a simple device that helps you put boundaries around your phone so you can actually be with your partner. You just pair the device to your phone and it locks distracting apps, and suddenly you're not half listening while trying to reply to texts or checking Instagram. Now, it's not about cutting out technology. It's about choosing presence during dinner, before bed, or when you're having a real conversation that deserves your full attention. Because relationships don't fall apart from one big thing. They fade from too many small moments of distraction. If you want to be more present with your partner, check out Brick. Go to getbrick.app/POR show for 10% off. That's getbrick.app/POR show.
Yeah, I think that body is such an, I mean, I've definitely felt that. I think it's like, if you're not feeling great about your body, and obviously if you have a partner that's not, you know, receiving it well, that's another whole thing. I mean, if you're in a situation where there's a lot of stress going on, whether that's your own feel, or let's say the other flip side of having kids is that you're just, like, you know, run down and tired and whatever, or maybe you start a new job, whatever life throws at you, do you just accept that this is a point in time? Or like, are there ways to kind of reactivate your SE?
So yeah, no, don't worry about, oh, it's very rare that the thing to focus on is adding stimulation to the accelerator. nearly always the idea is like, so what's hitting the brakes right now? And what control do I have over that? Are there things that I can do to like take some pressure off the brakes so that the accelerator is free to do its job? And there absolutely are going to be times when like, nope, the gas pedal is like fine, but man, the brakes are just on the floor right now. I got the foot brake on. I got the handbrake pulled up. Like we're just not going anywhere right now. Like if you just brought a brand new baby into your life, no, you're not going to be getting any sleep. The whole idea of your body is going to be weird and kind of just like baby hands touching your body and the whole meaning of your body parts is now about like parenting and how do you transition out of parenting mode into hey, sexy lady mode. Right. Like that takes practice and effort. So there is no more ironic way to not experience any interest in sex than to judge yourself for how little interest you have in sex. Because if you're like trying to like get in the mood and you're like, what's going on? And it's been weeks or months and I still am not in this place. And you're like judging yourself and criticizing yourself. And maybe your partner is like, should you see a doctor? Do you think there's something wrong with you? Is any of that activating the accelerator? Is that sex-related stimuli that's turned? No, it's all hitting the brakes. So if you like take sexual desire, take sexual interest, take sexual behavior off the table entirely, no pressure, no judgment, no performance anxiety, you just allow there to be like a breathing moment in your connection where you take space. When we study people who have great sexual connections, these are not people who necessarily sustain a strong sexual connection constantly. They're not the ones who never find that there is distance between them. They're the ones who, finding that there's distance between them, find their way back to each other.
Well, this is very timely because you talk about stress and how it can, you know, absolutely contribute to our SI hitting the brakes. But you also make a clear line between stressors and stress.
Oh, yeah.
I would love for you to explain what that is because to me, that was the most helpful definition. And also, how do we manage stress, not in a way that society tells us to manage stress, but in a healthy way?
Yeah. So the short answer is chapter 4 of Come As You Are and then all of burnout. Yes. So the single best predict. So Come As You Are is really focused on like women's sexual well-being, not because women most deserve sexual well-being, but because the cultural denial of their sexual autonomy and pleasure, access to pleasure, is the foundation of, I think, all the evils in the world. And it turns out the best predictor of a woman's sexual well-being is, surprise, her overall well-being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sure that applies to men too, right? Anyone's overall well-being is going to help them.
Yes. For everybody, yeah. So because people were like, this is the most important chapter in this book, that's actually why Burnout was the next book. So chapter 4 of Come As You Are and 1 of Burnout are beginning with this idea that the process of dealing with your stress, which is the physiological thing that happens in your body, the adrenaline and cortisol and all these things we read about with the fight or flight response, which is actually fight, flight, freeze, fawn. And then there's your stress. It's dealing with that is separate from the process of dealing with your stressors, which are the things that cause, that activate the stress response in your body. Our stressors, to take like an extreme example, are like traffic. Right? Like biologically, your stress response is the same when you're sitting in terrible traffic, when you are surrounded by douchebags, as it is when you're being literally chased by a predator, like a lion, right? Like, so you're on the savannah of Africa running and your body is doing what it is designed to do, feeding you this adrenaline and stuff so that you can run to escape, right? So you're sitting in traffic surrounded by douchebags and your body's pumping out this adrenaline and stuff and like trying to help you out. And running is not the behavior that's going to fix this situation. You just need to wait. So by the time when you're running away from a lion, if there's only two possible outcomes here, right? Either you get eaten by the lion or you survive. So imagine you run all the way back to your village and you outrun the lion and you jump up and down and you explain and you tell the story to your friends and family and you feel so relieved and grateful and the sun seems to shine brighter, right? When you get out of your car after you've been in traffic for 45 minutes, you get get out of your car, do you suddenly feel glad to be alive and the sun seems to shine brighter and you love your friends and family? Or do you still want to punch somebody in the face and you kind of accidentally take it out on the first mammal you see when you walk in the door?
Your partner.
Yeah. So that's the difference between dealing with the stress and dealing with the stressor. If you get home from the terrible traffic, you have dealt with the stressor, yay. If there is, you know, some douchebag at work who you just like, the way to deal with that is not going to be the way your adrenaline wants you to deal with it, which is to like, you know, lean over the table and slap him across the jaw. That is not appropriate. That's just not a thing you can do.
Legally.
Yeah. Like, no, literally for legal reasons, it is not correct. That is not the socially appropriate thing to do. The socially appropriate thing to do is to, like, have a rational conversation, maybe mediated. Like, you know, you are a grown-up who manages your feelings. You put the pause button on your stress response. You hold on to it until you are in an appropriate place. And then, separate from dealing with the stressor, you deal with the stress itself, which is you can deal with physical activity. You can deal with it with a big old cry. I love that one. Mm-hmm. Belly laugh, another great one. Creative self-expression, using your imagination. Just like sit in your office with your eyes closed and imagine that you are Godzilla and you are stomping all over the douchebag's office and destroying all their crap and their that. You're allowed to do anything you want in your imagination, right?
So how this comes back, let me know if I'm filling this in correctly, is stress is going to put the brakes on.
For most people, yeah.
Yes. So any ways that we can like de-stress and address this stuff, that's going to help with overall sexual happiness.
Yeah, because it fixes your overall well-being.
And also some people feel like they can distract themselves from stress with sex. And I feel like for me personally, having sex while I'm stressed actually adds to my anxiety and my stress. Mm. So it is okay to say to my partner, I'm taking a pause so I can work through my stress before we have amazing sex.
Right. So one of the things that we've gotten this question a lot is like, what happens when my partner and I have different, I would have said sex drives in the past, but now I want to say like SE and SI.
Levels of interest in sex or motivation.
Exactly. Like, how do you address that situation? I feel like what you hear in, you know, bad Cosmo advice is, you know, like set the candles, buy sex toys, like basically adding to the SE, where what I'm kind of gathering from you is maybe it's focusing on the SI a little more.
It's absolutely 100% focus on the SI more. Yeah. So suppose we got partner A and partner B. Partner A has higher interest in sex, would like sex more frequently. Partner B has lower interest in sex, would like sex less frequently. First of all, there is an automatic judgment about one of the person having a more correct level of sexual interest than the other one.
Yes.
Right? And that's wrong. That's already, you're starting off wrong right there.
That probably adds stress right away to
right.
the other
yeah.
person.
Because then one person is like the diagnosed patient. And usually it's the higher desire person who's like the better sexual interest. And the lower desire person is the worse. Like there's something wrong and broken with you if you have lower interest in sex. That already, so like, start from a place of like, both of us are equally correct and normal and healthy in our level of interest in sex. No one's broken. We just have a relationship where we need to like figure out a compromise, a way to make this work. And if I'm the higher desire partner in my relationship, then what I want to do is I want to figure out everything that's hitting my partner's brakes and just sweep them away, get rid of them. I originally heard this story actually from Sarah Wendell of
A Frolic, which is how we got connected, our network, shared network.
She tells the story of being in an elevator and listening to people having the conversation. Like these characters in these romance novels, they can be like literally running away from the bad guy. They're being shot at and they hide in a closet running away from the bad guy and they have sex in the closet while they're like, and this woman is like, I can't have sex if there's still a dish in the sink. Right? Like that's, it's a distraction. It's an interruption. Her brain is still on that dish and not letting it go. The wrong, easy way to address that is to like tell the person, well, you just need to like be more mindful, be more present in the moment, let go of the dish and turn your attention to the pleasurable things happening in the here and now. But what if I, as the higher desire partner in relationship with that person, heard my partner say, I'm sorry, I'm just like, my brain is really stuck on that last coffee cup. I, mm-hmm. as the higher desire person, can be like, you know what, baby?
Go fucking clean it.
I'm going to go clean that dish. And I come up like a superhero.
Yes.
I did the dish. You smell that dish soap, baby? Mm. I mean, I've literally heard stories about laundry. This is laundry's a really big one.
It's a huge
hitting
one.
The brakes, people, like, because there's so many steps and you just have to like wait until the next step is ready. So like, you know, you've got date night and the last load of laundry never got folded.
Yeah.
So the story as it was told to me was like, I'm in bed, I'm waiting for my partner to come up, I'm naked. I'm just like, can we just get this done?
The to-do list really fucks you up.
Yeah, I just want to cross it off. But partner comes up with the laundry basket, naked, and is like, hey, how you doing? I'm going to put away the laundry. I'm going to hang up each of your t-shirts. Doesn't make any sense to hang up a t-shirt, but that is the way you like it. And like, you know, like bending over in a sexy way. It's playful. It's supposed to be funny and silly. But yeah, if I'm the higher desire partner, if I want to have sex more frequently or greater pleasure with the sex that we have, then I want to get rid of everything that is hitting my partner's brakes.
And remove it for mm-hmm. your partner. But what about something like this? I'm asking for a friend. My friend says...
UA's question.
She cannot have sex in humidity or when she's sweaty and sticky. But her partner is totally fine fucking in that kind of environment. How could the partner help remove that brake for my friend?
I feel like an air conditioner costs about $100.
See, there's a solution to everything. There's a solution. You just need to find the solution.
Like, what is, like, put a big red bow on the box. Be like, baby, I made an investment in us.
I love this, but let's say this is a sore subject in your relationship.
Sure, which it is for a lot of people.
Which it is. And I feel like the more you bring it up, the more their brakes probably stop, right? Like, because now it's...
Welcome to the chasing dynamic, yeah.
Because I've never been in this situation, but I'm only like imagining if someone was like, why don't you want to have sex? Why don't you want to have sex? That's going to make me more nervous to have sex. How do you have these conversations, you know, in a way that you can understand what their breaks are, so it becomes a solution rather than just having this circular convo or, you know, pulling out all the exciters that aren't doing anything, just adding pressure.
So how do I ask my partner for, how do I talk to my partner about question? Ultimate answer is, well, you just talk about it. You just do it. And again, it's not about like, how do I physically go and do it? It's what are the things that are standing in my way? What am I afraid could possibly happen? I generally answer this question with two dad jokes. One,
we love dad jokes.
How do hedgehogs have sex? Very carefully. And then this is a 1930s, 40s guy arrives, a musician. He arrives in New York City. He says to his cab driver, hey, fella, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? And the cab driver looks at him and goes, practice, practice, practice. Get it? How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. So the answer to how do I talk about it is very carefully and practice, practice, practice. The real question to ask is, well, there's a lot of questions to ask. And what I've found is that one of the most useful things that I can do in a short amount of time is to instruct people what the good questions are. Because it's not, how do I want sex more? The question is, what is it that I want when I want sex? Hmm. What is it that I don't want when I don't want sex? What is it that I like when I like sex? What is it that I don't like when I don't like sex? For both people to answer these questions and be able to talk about it, because it's not just that you like the pleasure and you don't just want orgasm, because you can do that by yourself. Mm-hmm, so what is it about having another person, and specifically this other person with you, that contributes something powerful and important to your well-being, to your sense of joy, to your sense of fulfillment as a human being? What is it that you want? What is it that you like or don't want and don't like? And that opens up the possibility of having a conversation that's not about the power struggle, because so often people frame sex as a resource to fight over in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. It is there. I'm gonna not go to the dark place of things that have happened culturally.
We can save that for another episode, but it is a really great point, because are sold into this narrative that in a new relationship, you fuck like bunnies. And then at some point, you get so used to each other that you start having less sex and the sex is not good. But what you're really saying here, and this is my takeaway, is that sex gets better with time because you start to learn your partner's SEs and SIs. And it becomes a puzzle. How do we crank up the SEs and how do we get rid of the SIs? Mm-hmm. So in that theory, sex should get better and better as you get to know your partner.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely how it works. When people are willing to abandon the script that somebody somewhere planted in our heads that says, here is how sex is supposed to work. It's supposed to be spontaneous. It's supposed to happen easily. You're supposed to sort of, it has an order of operations. You do things in this order. You engage in these behaviors, but not in these other behaviors. Boom, 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 and you're done. And we can tell somebody's done because somebody ejaculates in somebody else's body. That's how you know. If we are willing, and in the research on people who have extraordinary sex, this is what they say. How do you get to be a person who has sex that makes you feel like you're like plugged into the universe? You abandon everything you were ever taught about sex, gender, pleasure, bodies, trust, shame, love, and you connect deeply with what those things are for you personally, regardless of what somebody taught you. And you connect deeply with what those things are for your partners, regardless of what the world taught you that was supposed to be. You really pay attention to you and to your partner. And you customize sex and make it exactly what it can be for you specifically without regard to what anybody says it's supposed to be. This is the confidence and joy thing that I talk about all the time. Confidence is knowing what is actually true, knowing that responsive desire is not only normal, but great. Knowing about the dual control model, knowing what kinds of stuff hits your brakes, knowing that one level of desire is not better or worse than another level of desire. Yeah. And joy is the hard part. Joy is loving what's true.
Yeah.
About your sexuality, your body, your relationship, and the world you live in. And knowing what's true and loving what's true requires that you recognize the ways that you've been lied to your whole life about how sex should work. Mm-hmm. And when you can do that, you become freed up to do exactly what you were talking about, to begin to like pay really great attention to your own brakes and accelerator, to your partner's brakes and accelerator, and to play the game of like, how can we create space for our erotic selves to emerge under the like mountainous pile of other crap we have to deal with in our lives, to be able to play with each other in this specific, fun, goofy way we humans play.
I love that. And I think, I mean, there's so many takeaways. We'll move on to that. This episode has just been jam-packed, you know, nuggets and stuff. And obviously people can read your book.
It's 110,000 words.
That's it. People can read the book to even get more. But I think the biggest thing I learned from this, and I know it's one of those things that I think I knew, but I didn't think about as much, of just how much environment plays in to sex. The whole like working off of, you know, the stressors and what is, you know, pumping those brakes. Like I never thought that was the way to kind of get you the sex life that you wanted. Like it's almost like counterintuitive, yet it makes so much sense. So I think for me, that's a really great takeaway from all this. And I mean, you keep drilling this home besides the two things that you pointed out. Everything is normal. There is no right or wrong. Like no one is better or worse. And I think that can change at different stages of your life based on what's going on. And, you know, if something like someone can't orgasm or like something is coming up, it's not that there's something wrong. It's just maybe there's a stress that's happening that's causing this.
Yeah. And, like, for example, you're worried about how long your orgasm is taking.
Yeah. And I feel like sometimes we jump to like, what am I doing wrong? Or what am I doing wrong for my partner? And it's usually not about that. It's usually about these external contexts that's happening. Yes.
Yeah, it frees up the whole like blame, judgment. Like you can just be set free from all of that stuff and be like, so here's this puzzle that we have. How do we solve it together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not being afraid to communicate. I think sex is the one area that a lot of people are afraid to communicate because it feels so personal.
It feels so high stakes, right? Like we really don't want to hurt our partner's feelings and make them feel judged or criticized in any way. And we're all so tender and like it feels like the least little criticism could just like devastate them.
Yes.
If I have any like concrete tip about communication, stay as positive as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. Make your partner feel like a superhero. I love how we do XYZ. I want our sex life to be the best sex I've ever had with anybody ever.
Yeah.
And let's talk about how we can create that together.
I love that. And I think just the words of affirmation actually do play so much into it. I think what you were saying too, of just being with the partner characteristics, how much that impacts.
Trust.
And I definitely can see that.
Appreciation, gratitude, all the like self-help buzzwords. Yeah. I know, like I say things like gratitude and affirmation, and I'm like, oh, please, but no,
but
really. They're so good.
It's so true.
Yeah. And usually if things aren't going well in your sex life, there is something deeper going on that's not just physical for the most part. Not always, but yes.
It's all related. My takeaway is after reading your book, I just thought, wow, society's really fucked up about the way we educate and talk about sex. You even mentioned the fact that before someone turns 18, everything about sex is about no, 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 all the dangers and fears around sex. As soon as a woman turns 18, she's expected to be this minx, like, go fuck, go have the best sex of your life. And she hasn't been taught to do that. And then if she has too much sex or too little sex, her boobs are too big or too little.
You are always doing it wrong.
You are always doing it wrong. It's
failing.
Always too much. Or too little, and the normal way of doing things, nobody's doing it that way. What I took away was we have to unsubscribe from these beliefs that came out of nowhere. And you talk about accidental environment. You were brought into an environment to learn all of this, not by your own choice, because you were accidentally brought into this world. By your parents.
But
you didn't get to choose. But any given moment in time, we have the option and the power to question, do I actually believe this? Or did I just freely subscribe to this belief without even questioning it? So that is really empowering to know. I also love this idea of creating the best sex with your partner. Something we talk about on our show is everybody loves to list their turn-ons and turn-offs. And I would challenge people to stop doing that, because it's not one size fits all. Your turn-ons with one partner are going to be different with another partner. The fact that I love forearms on my current partner does not mean that I will love every forearm that I see. So I think it's great to know that, like, the concept that sex is a very customized thing makes it much more liberating to know that whatever you experience with your sexual partner is different from time to time, and you can treat it like an experiment and just keep experimenting.
Yes. And it changes with every level of granularity. So like, you may love the forearms on this person, but like no other forearms.
Yeah.
And also when this person with the great forearms like touches you in the special way in the certain special spot, today your knees melt. But tomorrow you're like extra overwhelmed and exhausted, and that same certain special someone touches that same certain special place in the certain special way, and you're like, will you please just go
right
do the dishes?
Not the same.
That is normal. Yeah. That is how our brain's perception of sensation works. That is normal.
I think that's really important too, because like for me, I'm at the start of a new relationship, and I think like sometimes you fear that like that honeymoon period will be over. And I think that knowing that it's normal, that things go in waves, is super helpful. That there's nothing wrong per se. Like this is just life, and sex is one part of life. But if we were just having sex all the time, like humanity wouldn't be doing anything else.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
like you have to sleep sometimes.
We just be procreating all the time. That's it.
Well, you wouldn't. The weird thing, this is a side note, but there is actually not a relationship between frequency of intercourse and reproduction.
Oh, shit.
Just like more about the time when you do it.
Yeah. Because the presence of the egg is the limiting factor. And like, it's there whether you have sex or not. And if the sperm is present when the egg is present, then there's a possibility of pregnancy. So if you have sex every day, like 28 days out of 30, there wasn't any chance you were going to get pregnant anyway. So anyway, people are like, oh, is the reason we have a reduction in population because people are having sex less frequently? No, that is not why.
No.
Yeah.
No,
not at all.
They're just using contraception. That's all.
Yes. Yeah.
They don't want kids. That's all.
Yeah,
that's
people are maybe making choices and having control over their bodies more than they ever have at any point in history. Mm-hmm. Like, I would rather be alive now than at any time in the past. And I'm sure God, I hope 50 years from now, if I'm still here, I'll be like, I'd rather be alive now than at any other time, because people are more free, they have more opportunity to choose, and they have more cultural permission to be exactly who they are and love exactly who they love and enjoy what they love.
I love hearing that. Thank you so much, Emily. You know, this is, we were only able to cover like one third of the book. There's just so much more in the book. In addition to all
of this. We didn't even talk about orgasm.
We didn't talk about orgasm.
That was on our list, yes.
I want to talk about the hymen myth, which was like, whoa, what the fuck? That's crazy. So I guess this will be a great teaser for anybody who has not read your book or listened to your book. I've been listening to it audio, and it's so great to hear your voice here, and then I hear you on my walks. And so there's just so much more to uncover with the book, but also your book Burnout is fabulous. You wrote this with your twin sister. That's crazy. She's a musician. Burnout affects so many aspects of our life, including our sex life. So also a very important book to read and put on our radars.
That of any book, this is, Burnout is the one I would wish least were relevant to people's lives, but it is just more and more relevant since it came out in 2019.
So is there any other ways, like any websites or any other ways that people can learn more about you?
I'm of social media, mostly on Instagram these days, and mostly for fun. E Nagoski, E N as in noodle, A-G-O-S-K-I.
Awesome. We'll also link it in our show notes.
Thank you for just changing sex education for us, finally. After so much time of, you know, growing up false information. Thank you so much for finally just disrupting what we've been learning and being like, hold up. Come on, guys. Let's get our shit together. You are such a hero.
What if everything you thought was true wasn't true? Yay. I'm so glad. I would never have expected when I was writing Come As You Are and, you know, destroying my own sex life, not permanently, that it would have the kind of impact that it's had. It's hard to even understand what a positive impact it's had on people's lives. And so thank you for telling me, because it's like I can look back on that and be like, that was worth it. It worked.
So worth it. So worth it. Everyone deserves to have better sex. And you are doing that for us. So thank you for making the world a more healthier sexual place, if that's the way to think about it. We're going to wrap up this episode. Thank you again, Emily, for being a part of the show. And if you haven't done so yet, subscribe to The Psychology of Relationships today so you don't miss an episode. And we'll see you all next week.
Bye.